This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
Now, last year, I was lucky to be at the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast, and I saw South African runner Caster Semenya. Actually, had a chat to her coach at the time, and she said, well, Caster doesn't generally do interviews, but maybe she will another time. Now, we spoke to the organisers of the Commonwealth Games on the Informer last year, and they said that they welcomed inclusivity and had no problems at all with Caster competing. But just a few days after I saw her, the International Federation of Athletics put in place some new rules, which have banned some intersex athletes from competing in athletics, especially those with high testosterone. Last year on The Informer, Dina Curry spoke to Morgan Carpenter, who is the Chief Executive of Intersex Human Rights Australia, about what this issue is.
Intersex is a word for a whole range of different variations that mean that somebody was born with a body that doesn't fit medical norms for female or male bodies. So we have sex characteristics that don't fit medical norms. And there are at least 40 different intersex variations, each with a very different impact on somebody's body, including genetics, gonads, genitals, and other issues. So we're really diverse. We're an astonishingly diverse population. The IAAF and the IOC, they're only concerned with a very small number of intersex variations, and they are intersex variations where somebody, well, they're really concerned about this notion that if intersex women compete, then that means that endosex, non-intersex women, are going to suffer. So they're only concerned with a small number of intersex variations.
The International Association of Athletics Federation, or IAAF, has recently come under fire since releasing its new regulations for the female classification, specifically focusing on athletes that show traits commonly found in intersex people. Although there are typically separate categories for men and women in sport, when it comes to the category of women, there's been persistent concern around the issue of fairness, especially when it comes to the variation of athletic ability, something not found amongst male competitors.
Sporting competition has, for many decades, problematized the bodies of women athletes. So an Olympic official, a US Olympic official, in the 1950s, this guy was called Norman Cox, was talking about how the IOC should create a special category of competition for unfairly advantaged hermaphrodites who regularly defeated normal women, less skilled, childbearing types with largest breasts, wide hips, and knocked knees. And so there is a very long history where the bodies of women who don't fit stereotypes of what it means to look like a woman have been targeted.
Regulating intersex athletes may be more difficult than it seems and raises many questions.
How do we know if an athlete has higher than typical levels of testosterone? If a woman athlete has that level? I mean, that might be picked up in doping, but if you look at the history of the way the guidelines have been used, they've been picked up when doctors or other officials involved in events identify some kind of deviation from norms for sex characteristics. So they're looking for physical characteristics that appear to be unusual or less common in women. So they're specifically looking for people that are essentially non-conforming. And often that's associated with some degree of either gender non-conformity or just a disinterest in fitting Western standards of what a female is supposed to look like or supposed to dress like. And we see some of the same kinds of assertions made even about, you know, amazing black women tennis players. You know, there's all sorts of language that is used about their bodies and their femininity or perceived masculinity that is also quite horrific. There have been instances where white European athletes have talked about themselves as being the first white athletes to cross the finishing line. So there's very clearly an intersection here between how women are supposed to look and what it means to be a black athlete.
Although there are differences athletes do accept and categories that they're willing to work within, the difference between intersex women and non-intersex women is far from the difference found between men and women.
There is agreement that men have a performance advantage in athletics over women, and the Court of Arbitration in Sport heard that was between 10 and 12% a performance advantage. Nobody is complaining, and nobody is saying that intersex women have a performance advantage that even comes near that. The claims that the IAAF was making was that there's between a 1 and 3% advantage, which is pretty marginal, and that's comparable to many other kinds of advantage, like athletes who are able to metabolize oxygen better, or athletes that have a higher pain tolerance. So there's all sorts of advantages that athletes have that are not being touted in the same way here.
So what's the solution? Will intersex athletes be allowed to compete with other men and women without constant concern surrounding fairness? Will they be forced to undergo medical intervention? Or will they be treated as an entirely separate gender identity, unable to compete amongst their peers? It all seems a bit ridiculous when you break it down in this way, doesn't it? Because this is the athlete's body. They're not doing anything other than competing with the tools that they've been provided to live their life every single day. When we draw a line in the sand and say, you're on the unfair side because of the way that you were born, can we really call this fair?
One of the issues that is happening here is that intersex children in global north countries, in high-income countries, and even in many middle and low-income countries, are subjected to medical intervention early, which can have consequences for how our bodies function for the rest of our lives. And in some cases, the women that are competing in sports have discovered through these rules are people that have not been subjected to that kind of medical intervention. And what we're being shown in these rules is quite blatant. It's what happens to intersex people the world over, that we are forced to take treatment as infants or children or adolescents, or later in life, we're forced to conform. And at the same time, we can see that clinicians have, in some ways, adapted to a legal environment where some countries have created such classification. And what they're doing now, what they're saying in these guidelines, is that either you are forced to take the treatment, or you will be othered and excluded as a member of a third sex or as competing with men. So this is really, you know, the way that intersex people are treated in our societies writ large. We are, at the same time, normalized by medicine. We are forced to be either female or male. And at the same time, because of the construction of these new categories legally, we are othered as neither female nor male. And this tears people apart.
Now, that was Dina Curry, and he was talking last year to Morgan Carpenter, who is the Chief Executive of Intersex Human Rights Australia. We've covered this story in various forms on The Informer, and I'm sure we will continue to talk to people, Toby.
Yeah, and it's worth saying as well that Rachel Tyler-Jones also contributed reporting on that story. What's your reaction to that? I mean, you saw Caster race, and like, I think it's, you know, how do you feel when hearing kind of this decision?
I feel deeply uncomfortable, even as a molecular biologist, having worked in this space, that people are being defined by their biology, and especially by the forced treatment for Caster to continue competing in a sport that she clearly loves. And she was a South African Sportswoman of the Year only a few years ago. Mm. So what's happened since, as you may have heard on the news, is that that appeal that Caster made to the Court of Arbitration has been thrown out. There is one more court that she can go to, I believe, in Luxembourg, but unless it's on a legal technicality, it's probably not going to be overturned. Mm. But I think this has thrown up tremendous amount of debate in the last couple of days, and it's really going to change the sport. This is a landmark ruling. Yeah. So I expect we'll be covering more of this in the future. Now, coming up after the break, we're going to be hearing from Simon Ruth and about whether the ban on poppers is likely to happen or not. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
Well, as you may well be aware, there is presently a review being conducted by the Therapeutic Goods Administration into amyl nitrate, or as many of us know, the substance poppers. As you will hear indeed in this interview I conducted earlier with Simon Ruth, the CEO of Thorn Harbour Health, the TGA originally went in relatively hard in terms of proposing a ban and has since been conducting community consultations in Melbourne and Sydney, where, as Simon indicated, there have been some quite uncomfortable and quite interesting conversations happening.
So the TGA put out a public meeting communique back in March where they talked through what the outcomes were from the Melbourne and Sydney events that they held. And, you know, they did give a pretty honest reporting of both of those events. They talked about the fact that in Melbourne, so the background to this is that they were looking at making amyl equivalent to, you know, incredibly hard drugs and making it illegal, making it Schedule 9, which would mean that, you know, it was sitting at the same sort of level as heroin and completely unavailable. And in the public meetings, they acknowledged that there appears to be some level of therapeutic use, particularly for people engaged in anal sex, that amyl does, you know, have a productive use in the community. They talked openly about what the potential harms were, and they heard from the community about how all those harms could be alleviated. And they went through the scheduling options, and so the other scheduling options, amyl is still currently scheduled. It's scheduled as an angina drug, it's just not available as an angina medication because it hasn't been used pharmaceutically for that for many years, but it still sits there in the scheduling. So the schedules they talked through was it could stay at that schedule, which is Schedule 4, which would mean you'd have to go to a GP and get it prescribed. It could go to Schedule 3, which is a pharmacy medicine like pseudoephedrine, where you go to the pharmacist, it's behind the counter, you ask for it, they may ask you for your ID, you have to explain why you want it. And the benefits to that is that we would know that it's decent quality and we could, you know, encourage safer packaging because a lot of the harms were associated with people drinking it. So that, you know, if we had it as a Schedule 3, you would definitely get it as a, you know, you'd have to have that conversation with a health professional to get it. Then there's Schedule 2, which is like paracetamol, which you just go in and you grab off the shelf of a pharmacy and you buy on your way out. And in Melbourne, we talked about leaving it unscheduled because the problem with all of the other scheduling is that it means that they have to find a company prepared to pay to get the drug registered for that use. So it doesn't matter what schedule, if they reschedule it, it requires a company to come in and pay possibly a significant amount of money, up to a couple of $100,000, to get the drug made available onto the marketplace. So we in Melbourne had talked a lot about ensuring that it remains unscheduled until they actually know that there's someone prepared to be in the marketplace and be selling the drug and be prepared to do that. And so the principles that we put forward as Thorn Harbour Health, we said we don't want people to be further criminalised, so we don't want gay men or businesses or young people who are increasingly using it to be turned into criminals. We definitely don't want to see a break in supply, so we need to ensure that no matter what they do, it remains available throughout that period. We do accept that it could be safer and it could be better quality, and so we're happy to work on ensuring that that's the case. And we also don't want our community members to be forced into humiliating situations of having to go to doctors or pharmacies and essentially beg and explain why they require it and for what sexual practices they require it. And our community should not be put through that for a drug that we have known how to use quite safely for the last 50 years.
Absolutely. What has brought this review on?
It appears that the review's been brought on. No one's 100% sure, but it looks like an ophthalmologist in another state sent a letter to the TGA. There's some evidence coming out of Europe that one of the... So it's a class of drugs called alkyl nitrites, and that one of them, which isn't generally available in Australia, isopropyl nitrite, causes some macular problems in your eyes. And there's a very small piece of research that cites, I think, 7 cases of this occurring in Europe. And somebody sent that piece of research through to the TGA. The TGA then went out to who they think are their experts, toxicologists and poisons and the Pharmacists Guild, which is the Small Business Association for Pharmacies, and they all said, we don't care, do whatever you want with it, because none of us are involved in amyl nitrite. We don't have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. So then they made their decision to make it illegal, and then someone discovered that that was occurring and went to the gay press about it, and then suddenly there was an explosion of people saying, hold on, there actually is a use for amyl nitrite. There are a lot of people in the community who rely on it, and it's not as dangerous as you seem to think it is.
Mm-hmm. What was the tone of the public meetings?
Well, look, the public meetings, certainly the Melbourne one was fascinating. You know, the people that the TGA sent along, the bureaucrats, you wouldn't say are people who, you know, have probably seen anyone use amyl nitrite before. It was a fairly conservative group of people. There was one point where John Skerritt, who's the secretary of that department, who's an older gentleman, and I do mean gentleman when he speaks, and a young person put up their hand and said, John, have you ever used amyl for the purpose of receptive anal sex? Which John then had to reply he hadn't. And they said, well, clearly then you're not qualified to talk on this subject, are you? So it was an interesting and colourful meeting, which got more colourful because, you know, I was giving the community response. So I was quite colourful in the presentation I gave. The bureaucrats talked a lot about poisonings and all the harms associated with it. But some of those harms, you know, they talked about the fact that 20 or so people get ambulance or call poisons lines each year to do with amyl nitrite. Yet we know that in Victoria alone, 3,000 people end up in ambulances because they overdose on aspirin and paracetamol. So, you know, there's harms and there's harms. It's yes, there are some people who manage to poison themselves, but we can do things to prevent that. And it's nowhere near the harms that people were imagining that it causes.
Mm-hmm. And when are we likely to have the TGA's decision?
Look, we've got no idea. I'm hearing conflicting results. Someone has said we may hear in July and someone else has said we may hear next year. So what the process is, the evidence then goes up through two separate committees. Those committees each make recommendations and then that goes to a more senior medical professional, and we don't actually know who that is. There's a panel of them and one gets selected to make the decision, and then that decision then comes back down through the process. And it could be a decision to get more information, it could be a decision to leave it to state governments, it could be a decision to reschedule it. Regardless of what the decision is, there will probably be a 1 to 2 year period at which it comes into effect. So people will have a chance to stock up if they want to, or to possibly mount legal challenges or do whatever else they want to do. So it's not going to be a fast process, but there will definitely probably be changes there.
Great. That was Simon Ruth, the CEO of Thorn Harbour Health, giving us an update on what's going on with the poppers ban, or has it hopefully seems like it will. It should be not a ban at all.
Not a story, not a news tip. Want us to dig into something? We want to hear from you. Email us, theinformer@joy.org.au, or text us at 0427 Joy 949.
Well, would you believe it, but there's an election on, and you can tell there's an election on because a very large number of people are having their lives ruined by some quite silly things they have done at different stages of their lives, sometimes on the internet, sometimes in the real world. Keeping track of exactly how many candidates have quit in the last week has proven to be genuinely difficult, but fortunately here at The Informer we've had some assistance from an Informer reporter, Sai Sri Ravishankar. Sai, welcome on air to The Informer.
Thank you, Dobby.
Yeah, so you've been looking into a couple of the candidates. One was a Liberal candidate who resigned for homophobic remarks. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
So Liberal candidate Peter Killen has resigned as the candidate for Wills after controversial comments he made about homosexuality, and in particular, Liberal MP for Goldstein, Tim Wilson's sexuality, resurfaced. Mm-hmm. Killen referred to homosexuality as a lifestyle that carried appalling health risks. Though Killen apologized, he had initially refused to stand down. Mm-hmm. He seems to be a repeat offender, having been forced to apologize after comments he made in his submission to the Ruddock Review into Religious Freedom mm-hmm. about so-called dangerous posts by gay people were revealed. Traditionally a Labour safe seat, Wills is now a Labour Green marginal seat. Although the Liberal Party is out of the running in Wills, with early voting underway, Killen will still be on the ballot. Mm. This is not the first time a Liberal candidate has been called out for comments against the LGBTQI+ community in this election. Mm. Liberal candidate Gurpal Singh, who is running in Scullin, a Liberal safe seat, recently apologized for comments he made equating homosexuality to paedophilia. In a 2017 interview, Singh commented legalization of same-sex marriage may increase cases of sexual abuse of children. 53% of Scullin had voted in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage. With back-to-back scandals rocking the Liberal Party, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has called for his party to clean up its vetting process. Despite the Liberal Party having quite a number of homosexual MPs, these comments seem to reflect the homophobic and transphobic ideology that the Liberal Party has come to represent.
Well, there is absolutely a complex tension that right now... thank you very much for that, Zaya. That was a great kind of little wrap of just the last few days. There is definitely a tension because it seems like sections of the Liberal Party have been taken over by quite right-wing forces, and that's particularly true in Victoria, which is kind of an uncomfortable situation for the Liberals federally because Victoria is obviously one of the most progressive states in the country. But Ian, the Liberals aren't the only political party who have been having some problems, are they?
Well, I think it goes right across the board, and it certainly doesn't not affect the Labor Party. The young gay candidate for the constituency of Melbourne, Luke Creasy, I think he's been on Joy a few times. What was revealed was a joke, or well, he would describe it as a joke or an immature comment about rape that he posted on Facebook several years ago, and I think there was also some Twitter posts that he put out. He said in a statement, they were stupid and immature and they no way reflect the views that I hold today, and I apologise for these posts which have been removed. I just think it reflects, well, one is that when people stand for office, they probably are not thinking 10 years prior to that or 5 years prior to that that they might be standing for office, and people do all sorts of very, very silly things when they get agitated on social media.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is definitely true that a very large number of people would find very quickly that they would get into trouble with old social media posts that they had made. And of course, social media companies like Facebook make it very, very difficult to delete them all. Like there are, well, on Facebook, it's possible to limit past posts. You have to go through and manually delete almost everything you've actually created. And yeah, unless you basically delete your whole profile, that material is still going to be out there. It's not just people getting into trouble on social media, of course. There is One Nation's number two candidate in for the Senate in Queensland, Steve Dixon, and the ostensive head of their party in Queensland, was also forced to resign earlier this week after footage was released on A Current Affair. The footage had originally been filmed by Al Jazeera during Steve Dixon and James Ashby's abortive trip to the United States, where you may have seen or heard clips of them discussing getting large amounts of money from the NRA and radically altering Australia's gun laws. There were also clips of Pauline Hanson discussing how the Port Arthur massacre was in fact a conspiracy because she'd read a book, a blue book. Footage wasn't shown by Al Jazeera, but it was shown by Channel 9 of him in a strip club saying a number of quite unappealing things. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong necessarily with people going to a strip club at all, and I certainly don't have a problem with people making their money from that kind of living. Good on people. That's good fun. But a lot of the comments he was making were highly racialized and I think quite problematic in that context. But it's interesting that ostensibly what Steve has been forced to resign for was not trying to game Australia's gun laws effectively for the sake of getting large amounts of money, but for doing something that's ostensibly completely legal in much of Australia. So these are wild times, and candidates are kind of falling, more candidates are falling by the day. There was still a lot of other stuff that happened this week in politics, and so earlier today I spoke with Shannon Malloy, who is a senior reporter at news.com.au, to cover off on some of the other issues that we may have missed.
Well, this week has been all about policy for the two major parties. Labor really wanted to kick off strongly on Sunday with a massive focus on childcare. They've announced $4.7 billion for subsidised and, in most cases, free childcare for Australian families, and another $2 billion for free dental care for senior Australians. In contrast, the Liberals have been all around the country announcing everything from defence industry investments to agriculture investments. So both parties have really tried to bring the campaign back to what they have in store for Australia. Unfortunately, all of that has been distracted by a series of candidate controversies and scandals that has sort of hijacked the whole message.
And which of those have been the most serious, do you think? Will they have a large impact?
In terms of the two candidates in Victoria for the Liberal Party that were dumped, neither of them were in seats that they probably would have had a chance of winning. But the real damage comes in kind of reinforcing the belief of many that the Liberal Party has a problem with its far right wing conservative faction, that it attracts the sort of people that have views that aren't in step with the broader community. So these candidates aren't a significant loss, but it just does damage because the entire country is focusing on, you know, the comments that are just appalling from these two individuals particularly, rather than what the Liberal Party and Scott Morrison has a vision for the country.
And do you think Scott Morrison has handled those controversies well?
The Liberal Party was very quick to act on Wednesday when the two candidates were exposed for their social media comments. There was Jeremy Hearn, who made a series of really bizarre anti-Muslim comments, everything from, you know, Muslims are secretly trying to take over the government to, you know, their ideology means that they can never be true Australian citizens. And then there was this bloke called Peter Killen, who made some really disgusting comments about one of his own colleagues in Liberal, Tim Wilson, about him being a notorious homosexual, whatever that means. I don't know what makes you a notorious homosexual. Commenting on, you know, the gay lifestyle being unhealthy. Within so in the first case with Jeremy Hearn, he was dumped by 9:30 in the morning, essentially. And with the second, within 2 hours, he had also stepped down. So that's, you know, credit where it's due. The Liberal Party acted really quickly. But there are a number of other candidates that have skeletons in their closet. There's one in Tasmania today, Jessica Whelan, who is denying that these social media posts, again, very anti-Muslim, very sort of vile stuff about women who support Islam deserving to be enslaved. She says that's not her. I don't know, but Scott Morrison is so far standing by her. So, you know, when it doesn't matter if that candidate is in the seat or not, they act pretty quickly. When it's in perhaps a bit more of a winnable seat, they're a bit slower to act.
And the first of the televised debates was on Monday. Who won the debate and what impact do you think it'll have?
Bill Shorten won the debate, according to those in the room. Those watching at home were a bit more mixed, which I think probably reflects the opinion polls that show he is not the preferred Prime Minister, even though Labor are ahead. I think he did pretty well. He articulated Labor's policy fairly strongly, but Scott Morrison as well appeared quite calm. The most criticism about his appearance at the debate was that he doesn't sort of seem to know what his vision for Australia is. They have a lot of little small target plans, but there's no sort of overarching message like there is with Labor's campaign about better health, better schools, a fairer Australia. I think what that did, though, that win for Bill Shorten, was give him a bit of a kick after a pretty awful week last week on the campaign trail, where he clashed with reporters, he faced repeated questions about the cost of Labor's emissions reduction target that they can't answer because it's sort of impossible to put a number on. So I think the win gave him a bit of a spring in his step, and if anything, it probably made Scott Morrison realise that he's kind of got to fight for this if he wants it.
And what's your prediction for who you think will win?
Oh gosh,
Labor.
It's a brave man who predicts these things. We've seen a number of examples where opinion polls have said one thing, and then the outcome on election day has been something entirely different or something much more significant than expected. You only need to look at the Victorian state election to see that, you know, it was kind of neck and neck for weeks leading up to the poll, and then Labor romped home with this victory. So I don't know. The polling has Labor ahead on a two-party preferred basis. They're doing well in a number of marginal seats held by the Liberals that could swing to them. But yeah, I don't know if there are scandals that keep coming out with candidates. If Bill Shorten keeps getting stuck on questions that he can't answer, then who knows? It could be a very close contest.
That was Shannon Malloy, the senior reporter at news.com.au Pride.
This has been The Informer. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review on iTunes. It helps others to find the show.